Just a reminder that the final exam is October 19th. I had someone contacting me yesterday who had the wrong date. Remember, there was an error in the initial syllabus that I sent out, so don't get confused on that. I am going to waste everyone's time and correct that right now. Okay, at 1915, there is new information here, which is that the location will be in Hall Auditorium, so we can spread out. So that's actually good news. Exam 2 is coming up, so just be aware, it's November 12th, and I will start to think about where the material cuts off and begin to make plans and Q&A session time and send you information about the coverage and everything soon. Now that we're starting to get to where I can tell where we'll be cut off the material. Anyone have any questions about that? It'll be at 8 a.m. in Hubble again. Okay. So last time we started talking about Newton's second law. We sort of upgraded it. The real version of it is the net force is equal to the time rate of change of the momentum. And momentum is defined as mv. So if I do a derivative and distribute it properly, I get a term which is m times dv over dt plus dm over dv times v. And this first term is the one you're used to, it's ma. And the second term you've not seen, except for what we did last time, it's real. Basically, something where the mass is changing with time is where it's important. And there are real physical examples of this, but I'm not going to worry about it for our class. You may actually see some problems in the book that have that. If you're looking for extra problems to do, you're welcome to do them, but you're not going to see anything like that on our exam. And it's not that it's really that terribly difficult, but we have to draw the line sometimes on what we cover, so I'm not going to worry about that. So one of the really fabulous things about momentum is that if you're in an isolated system, so the hand of God doesn't come in, it's not sitting on the floor where something else is sort of involved, but if you have an isolated system, then the momentum is conserved. So whatever momentum you start with, that total vector momentum doesn't change no matter what happens in that problem. And this is a vector, so it's very powerful because this is three separate equations. So it's true in all dimensions. Many of the problems that you do, these will be one-dimensional things. But don't forget that it's really conserved in all three dimensions simultaneously. So you have, in fact, three scalar equations that come out of this. So it's really powerful. Just from the definition of momentum, we get a relationship between the change in momentum over some period of time is equal to the integral of whatever happens with the force over that time. Generally speaking, most of the problems you'll do, most of the things that are useful for you will be using these equations. Occasionally, you may have reason to use something with impulse. I cover impulse in part because I use it to derive momentum conservation like we did last time. But impulse is something that's useful when the force is hard to know anything about. So a bat hitting a baseball, for example, that force is a very nonlinear, strange thing with time, the bat's force on the baseball. And so it's really hard to know what to do with it, but you can still sort of quantify the net effect of the force through something called the impulse. So just be aware of that definition, and probably you'll have a few problems that involve it. So, we have used energy conservation, but energy conservation is not always easy to use. in particular, in some sorts of things, like where you have an explosion or you have friction involved, kinetic energy is not conserved. Okay? And sometimes there are instances where it's nicely conserved. And so, no matter really what happens, if it's an isolated system, momentum is conserved. So you can always use that if the system's isolated. Sometimes kinetic energy conservation is good. If you have billiard balls colliding and you're told there's no friction, kinetic energy conservation works beautifully. So you get an extra equation, right? Anything where this is true, where the kinetic energy is conserved, we say that's an elastic collision. And so the example we'll always keep in your head is sort of billiard balls, okay? If the kinetic energy is not conserved, we call it an inelastic collision. Here you have friction involved. You have explosions. You have two balls coming together where one, you know, they're made of clay and they stick, or they stick partially. Anything where it's sort of an ill-defined, complicated collision like that, where you are going to potentially have some energy loss, then we call it an inelastic collision, and that is your keyword that tells you that kinetic energy is not conserved and you cannot use that equation. Okay? And there are problems that are set up so that you are totally led to believe you should be using energy conservation and it doesn't work. So you have to be thinking, okay, what does work? And then it's momentum conservation. Alright, so just remember that. In any problem, if they tell you this, it means that. If they tell you this, it means that, and vice versa. Okay, so be aware of that. And so when kinetic energy is not conserved, you can't use this, but otherwise it might be a really useful equation. So just learn to pay attention to that. Okay, so I want to look at a problem, and in this problem, you take a gun and you shoot a bullet into a block of wood, and you look to see how the bullet becomes embedded in the wood, and you look to see how much the block rises. Okay, we call it a ballistic pendulum problem. So, what I'm going to ask you is, if you're given the mass of the bullet, the mass of the block, and you know the velocity of the bullet, how high does the block rise? So how might you go about doing this? What would you need to know in order to figure out how high the block rises? What do you think?
The angle.
Well, if I gave you the angle, but suppose, I'm not giving you the angle, but the angle, if I gave you the length and the angle, it's equivalent to knowing the height, so that's true. But if I don't give you either of those, and I just ask you to calculate the height or equivalently the angle, what would you need in order to be able to do that? What do you think? Okay, so if you know the energy it has after the bullet hits it, then a way of saying that is you know its kinetic energy at that point, because you could define potential energy as zero here. If you knew its kinetic energy here, because you know its mass, the mass of the bullet and the wood, you can calculate its velocity. So if you know its kinetic energy here, then you can set that equal to mgh, and you know how high it goes, by energy conservation. So that's perfectly good. So that is the second half of the problem. How are you going to get its energy at that point? If I told you how high it went, you could, from MGH, calculate its energy at that point, too. So we're going backwards now. So let's say that you're trying to find H, and you need the energy at this point in order to be able to determine that. And we'll assume the potential energy is zero, which means what you really are asking is, what is the velocity of the block at that point? You could think of it just in terms of energy. You have zero potential energy here, and you have a bullet coming in, which has 1/2 mv squared worth of energy, where vm is the mass of the bullet, and it varies in the block. So you could say that I have energy conservation, 1/2 mv bullet squared is equal to 1/2 times the mass of the block plus the mass of the bullet times the velocity of the block squared. Which then allows you to calculate the velocity, which you then use to get H. What's wrong with that picture? What do you think?
The collisions,
Yeah. Can you imagine what kind of crap goes on when the bullet embeds itself in a block of wood? You gotta rip the cellulose apart and get buried in there, and all that friction and sound and all that stuff. So there's energy going everywhere that you know nothing about. So it's a very inelastic collision. Right? Which means, yeah.
Would you be able to use impact?
Mean impulse? If you really knew something about that force, maybe, but you really don't. I mean, even if I told you how deep it varies in the block, you have no reason to believe that it's a constant acceleration. That's a very complicated thing. So, energy conservation does you no good. It's an inelastic collision. But momentum conservation works. And it's very simple. It's a one-dimensional thing. The mass times the velocity of the bullet is equal to the mass of the block of the wood plus the mass of the bullet, because that's the total mass, times the velocity of this thing there. And it works just like that. So once you then have the velocity of this, you can calculate how high it goes. Yeah. And once you have its velocity, you have its velocity, and then you can take the energy it has at the bottom and set it equal to the energy at the top of the motion. Because once the bullet has stopped in the wood, and it's practically a little hard to imagine, and in real life, perhaps the block begins to move a little before the bullet is really embedded, but let's not worry about that. Let's assume that the bullet comes in and embeds itself instantaneously into the block. And at that point, you're done with the inelastic collision. So you use momentum conservation to get that velocity. Then you know the kinetic energy, 1/2 mv squared, and you let it change into potential energy using energy conservation. So it's a two-stage problem. So if you know the velocity of the wood plus the bullet after impact. Use conservation of energy to get H by saying that 1/2 times the mass of the wood plus the block times the velocity of the wood plus the block squared is equal to mgh. You okay with that set? So that's the second half. To get the velocity of the wood plus the bullet, cannot use conservation of energy. It's complicated and it's inelastic. So instead, use P conservation. So you have the mass of the bullet times the velocity of the bullet, both are given, are equal to the mass of the bullet plus the mass of the wood times the velocity of the bullet plus the wood. And once you have that, you have this piece, which then can go in here. And you can then calculate how high you go. Yeah, that's good. Okay. Any questions on that? So to be explicit, just this piece says that 1/2 times the mass of the bullet times the velocity of the bullet squared does not equal to 1/2 times the mass of the bullet plus the mass of the wood times the velocity of the bullet plus wood squared. Okay, that's not a good equation. So you okay with that? So try to remember momentum conservation. You will very likely at some point on the MCAT or one of my exams or whatever in the future, you will see a problem that is set up so that you'll jump quickly on energy conservation. So think about it. Momentum conservation, I think to beginners, doesn't really pop in your head as easily, but it's really in many ways more useful because it should always work. So try to keep it in mind. Okay. So, it turns out that in many instances, fairly complicated things, extended bodies, systems of things that have interacted, like something that's going through the air that breaks into pieces and stuff like that, these systems seem very complex initially, but very often they can be thought of in terms of the system itself, as if it's not moving, but just whatever's happening inside that system, plus whatever happens to the overall system, sort of an average of the whole system. So a way to think about it is, if I have some sort of, you know, piece of crumbling clay or something, and I hurl it, okay? Then as it goes in the air, it becomes a very complicated system. You have it sort of break into all these various pieces, okay? And I sort of want to make a theoretical construct with you, which is, imagine I had this ball of crumbling clay, and I'm going to let its position as a function of time be described by this big vector, big R of t, okay? And I'm going to take that, and it gets thrown with some velocity v. And for the moment, what I'd like you to do is to imagine that it stays together in one piece. And we are able to just look at the center of that ball and where it goes as a function of time. And if that's the case, we're going to say it would go along this red line. Okay? And I'm going to continue to describe the position of that red line, where this ball would be in a scenario where it all stayed together, with this vector big R of t. Now, in fact, this ball breaks apart. And as it breaks apart, one thing that you may notice in terms of how I have it drawn is some pieces go over here, some pieces go over here. And that's, in fact, what happens in real life. And once it's broken apart, what I'd like to do is to describe the end pieces of this thing in terms of their motion by all these various little vectors. R sub 1 describes the position of this one piece. So this piece, for example, might have started right here, and as this is flying, it breaks apart, and here it is, and then it goes to here, and this little r sub 1 vector is the vector that describes the position of that little piece, okay? And vector 2, the second piece is described by this vector, the nth piece is described by that vector, and you can sort of imagine these vectors all sort of move as a function of time to follow these little pieces as they go through their motion. So are you okay with that? So with that picture in mind, what I'd like to do is to analyze the system a little bit. And we're not really saying what happens when it crumbles. You know, maybe there's a firecracker inside that blows it apart. Maybe as it sort of moves, pieces begin to move apart. But one thing you'll notice is relative to the direction it would have gone, this piece has had a little bit of a force put on it in the upward direction. This piece has had a little force put on it in the downward direction. So there's some interactions with the stuff inside there. You don't know much about it. So it's complicated. So again, I don't really know how to use energy conservation with that, but I do know that the momentum is conserved, regardless of what happens with this thing. So let us assume momentum conservation, and let's look and see what we can learn about it. So if momentum is conserved, the momentum that I start with is the mass of the entire ball times its big velocity. Whatever it is, the velocity of this entire ball. So that is this, okay? The mass of the big ball times the big velocity. Because momentum is conserved, if that's the beginning momentum I have, it has to be equal to, if I pick some point later after all the pieces have fallen apart, this momentum, vector momentum, has to be equal to the vector momentum summed over all the various little pieces, which would be the mass of little vector, little piece 1 times its velocity vector, plus the mass of little piece 2 times its velocity vector, all the way up to the nth mass times its velocity vector. And it's a vector sum. Okay, so they're all going in different directions, but if I sum the vectors of all those velocities multiplied by their momenta, multiplied by their masses, I will get this, or weighted properly by their masses. Okay? So, what is the velocity? If I break the velocity apart in terms of what it's actually equal to, this is the time derivative of the big R vector with respect to time, because that's what we mean. That's the big vector that describes the position of the big ball. This is the derivative of the little r vector with respect to time. This is the derivative of the little r2 vector with respect to time. This is the derivative of the little r to the nth vector with respect to time. Okay? Because I'm taking a derivative with respect to time of all of these things, basically I can cancel out the dt's, or you could say I can integrate out the time on both sides, however you want to look at it. But just like I could take... So if this is true, then this equation is true, which you can also think just by working backwards. If I have this equation and I take the derivative with respect to time, I get exactly that. So those are equivalent. So, if we take momentum conservation and we believe it, then it means that I have this strange equation in terms of relating the positions of all these things. And what you'll see is that on the left-hand side, I have something relatively simple, which is the total mass of this thing times the vector that describes where it would be if it didn't break up. Okay? And that is equal to, effectively, the mass-weighted sum of the positions of all the other pieces. The pieces that weigh more or have a bigger mass, their position vector sort of factors in a little more, if that makes any sense. So the right-hand side is complicated. You have all these little pieces going everywhere. But the left-hand side is not so bad. So maybe some of you, both sides look bad, but let me rephrase it. If I take a ball and I throw it and I tell you the velocity vector, you can use your one-dimensional or your two-dimensional projectile motion analysis and tell me where it belongs. Right? That's this side. That's all you're doing. The right-hand side is very complicated because it has all these stupid pieces going around. And so there's a relationship between the more complicated side and the stuff you already know, is sort of what I'm trying to say. So I'm going to define this big R vector as a big X, a big Y, and a big Z. Okay? And I'm going to say that the components of the little r vectors are going to be little x, little y, and little z. So you can sort of keep those straight. And because we have a big vector here, this equation right here is equal to three separate equations. This says that m... Let me move it over. This says that big M times the big X position is equal to M1 times little x1 plus M2 times little x2 plus all the way up to M sub n times little x sub n. Because it's a vector, that's true for all three components. So M times the big M times the big Y is equal to M 1 times little y1 plus m2 times little y2 plus all the way up to m sub n times little y sub n. And finally, we have the same thing for z. You okay with that? So we use this big X, Y, and Z, it turns out, may be particularly useful. I guess I've been describing it in terms of taking something simple that you think you can understand the motion of and looking to see how it turns into all this complicated stuff. In fact, the real usage of this is the other way around, which is if I see some complicated system, I can analyze that system by all the little pieces and from that derive what would be the equivalent sum of all those pieces. And that is something I can actually understand. So that's actually how we're going to use this, is to work backwards. So that means that what I'd like to do is to be able to determine this big X, this big Y, and this big Z as a function of time, even after the ball has broken apart. So even when I have a complicated system, right? And remember how we defined this big X, Y, Z, that's the big R vector, and that's really this thing when it's all together, or imagine to all have been together. So what I'm really saying is, what I want to do is to show you how to get all this complicated stuff, which is in fact what you find, because it broke apart, and from that, derive what this would have been if it had stayed together. which may be something you can analyze. This really is actually very simple. I'll do some demos and you'll begin to get the figure, you know, get the feeling for it in a minute. I'm really sort of doing my best to disguise that right now. But in, as you look back, I hope it will make a lot of sense. So from the equations that we have here, if I take this side and I divide it by the total mass, I have the big X. So big X is equal to M1 times X1 plus M2 times X2 all the way up to M sub N times little x sub N. And if I divide that all by the total mass, or another way to look at that would be if I take the sum over all I little masses of M sub I times x sub I and divide it by the sum of all the little masses m sub I, because that would be the total mass, then I get the coordinate big X. Okay with that? Similarly, big Y is equal to m1 y1 all the way up to m sub n little y sub n over big M, or the sum over I of little m sub I times little y sub I over the sum over the little m sub I's. Z, same thing, sum over m sub I times little z sub I over the sum over the little m sub I's. If you look at what this is, if I were to just ask you what is the average coordinate for all the n pieces in X, what you would do is you would take each X position, add them together, and divide by the number of masses. Right? That would give you an average X position. The problem is, what we're dealing with is a quantity that involves mass. So what you'd like to do is to have the bigger pieces count more, because they sort of carry more of that original ball, if you want to think about it. So what we have here is the mass-weighted average position. Each little piece of mass comes in and multiplies its X position. So big pieces multiply and give you a bigger number that contributes to this thing. The mass weighted average X position. Similarly for Y and for Z. So these coordinates, this coordinate system, this is something which we call the center of mass coordinates. So why is that useful? What it says is that I might have some big or complicated system, and I can think of it as being equivalent to a system where I have taken all the mass and put it at a single point at the center of mass point. Okay? So I can sort of look at the motion of this overall thing, and I can think of this complicated stuff and sort of add it up and figure out what the basic motion was of that original body. So you might ask, why do I really care? Well, the reason I really care is because I can take something that's really very complicated, okay? And if I know where the center of mass coordinate is in X, Y, and Z for this thing, I can support it at just that point. And it is as if all of its weight was at that one point. And it doesn't matter what all the complicated stuff is. Right? So you really ought to care, because without that, buildings would fall all over the place. Right? Engineers have to know where to support things in order to make them stand up. If you're going to lift, you know, if I have a big barbell, right, you don't come over to one side and try to lift it up. You intuitively know this. You go right in the middle. I mean, if you're really strong like me, you go right in the middle, you take your finger, and you just lift it right there. Right? But you would put it right in the middle, and it wouldn't work at all if you're off to the side. Okay? That point where you put your finger is the center of mass along this axis. And it's equivalent to saying, even though I have this complicated system, I can think of it as if it were all concentrated at just that point. And if I support it at that point, that's the only place I need to do it. I don't have to worry about anything else. Okay? So that's the power of this center of mass thing. It gives you the balance point, if you want to think of it that way. Okay. It's more than that, but basically that's the practical use and probably the way you want to think about it. So let's do a little example. This whole idea with the barbells might not be so easy if the barbells have different masses, if the weights are different. So imagine if I have, you know, some mass here, which I'll say is at x equals 0 is the center of that thing, and it's 30 kilograms, and it's connected by a massless but very strong bar to some other mass, which we'll say is 1 meter away. And let's say that this one has 50 kilograms. And then the question is, let's say that this is the x coordinate system. So then I would want to know where is x center of mass, usually done a little cm, for this object. Which another way to say that is, if I were going to put my hand on this thing and lift it, where would I put my hand if I had one hand to do it? So for this, we just go up here. We imagine that each of these balls represents a single one of these masses. So we have two of those. And we're given the weight of each, and we're given the position of each, so we can just look at the equation up on top and evaluate it. So XCM is equal to the sum over I of M sub I times X sub I over the sum over M sub I. So that will be equal to the mass of the first one, so I'll just call this 1 and this 2. The mass of the first one is 30 kilograms. Its x sub I is 0, plus the mass of the second, which is 50 kilograms, times its x, which is 1 meter, over 30 plus 50, which is the total mass, or 80 kilograms. So XCM is equal to 5/8 meters. 5/8 meters 4/8 is a half, right? So there's about a half meter. 5/8 would be somewhere right here. Does that actually make any sense to you? If that mass is heavier than this mass, you'll grip it a little bit closer to the big mass to try to balance it. Right? So another way to think about this is if I have a complicated body like this, and if I hang it by a single point and allow it to rotate, if I have a lot more mass over here than I have over here, it's going to do this. We're going to study that soon enough, but intuitively you know that it's going to do that. If I have a lot more mass over here, it's going to do that. So what's going to happen is it's going to hang, and the line, it's going to hang such that directly beneath this point of support will lie the center of mass along this line. So I can take a plumb bob, just a string with a weight on it, and what you can see is that it basically hangs such that this string passes through this point. Okay? And then if I hang this thing in any other way, because it's been done before so I know where the point is, the string won't hang so it passes through that point. So if I do three of these, then I have three intersect, actually even two is sufficient, but if I do three, I'll have three lines that intersect at the same point. So that means along those different coordinates, I found the center of mass along each of those. And for a body like this, it means you've determined it in 3D. So what that means is that has to be the center of mass. I can put my finger right at that point, and that's the balance point. Or, fortunately, I'm not an engineer, but okay, but you get the idea. So even a complicated thing. So here I have a cart, which is on an air track. The air track I'll turn on in a second. And this cart has a pendulum, so a big massive weight with a fairly thin arm, and it's free to rotate about this point. You're welcome to stand up. Sorry. So this just will go back and forth like that. Okay? So it's just a pendulum, just a big mass that goes back and forth. If we remove friction from it, so we have an isolated system, alright, I'm going to hold it until I release this thing. There's friction in the system, unfortunately. What do you see happening? It's not perfect, sorry. What's the basic motion? What's happening here? as this moves this way, the top goes that way, right? So it does this. Why? So if I remove friction from the problem and I have a constraint in 1D, if I start like this, as this moves this way, okay, this moves that way. So you have this kind of thing going on. Why? What do you think?
Maintaining the central position where the trying to keep the mass equal in the middle.
What's the initial momentum? There's no external force on this thing in this dimension, except for the fact that you saw that there was, but it's not perfect, but there's some friction. But suppose that there's not, okay? I have these two pieces like this. This piece swings this way, okay? As it swings this way, what's happening to the center of mass if this piece doesn't move? The center of mass position swings over here, but there is no external force on the system. What is moving that center of mass? So if you think of these two pieces as one total system, then where is it going to go as a function of time? Nowhere, because there's no force, there's no net external force on it, so it cannot go anywhere. So when you view it from the center of mass system, it's stable. The center of mass doesn't move. However, the pieces here can move just fine. But they move in such a way that the center of mass never moves. So if this piece moves over here, this piece has to move that way. So that's why you get it going like that. I think of a good example. If you stand on a rowboat and you try to walk forward, the rowboat goes that way, right? Skateboard. You ever done a skateboard? Try to move forward on a skateboard. What happens? It goes back, right? Sort of the same thing. You're pushing on it to move your body forward, which gives a force on it moving backward, and if it's not constrained, it's just going to fall back. So that's a little bit the same thing. So I think it's fairly straightforward if you have a discrete system of masses. So, you know, you could have you could imagine having a bunch of small asteroids and think of them as individual things and ask, you know, what is the center of mass of that system? It turns out that this, of course, is much more useful when you look at continuous things. Things like big planets or a baseball bat or something. You want to know if something that actually isn't obviously made of discrete little parts. So we want to look at it in that limit. So if we do that, what I really mean is imagine that we have some coordinate system. And I have some arbitrary shaped potato-like thing out there, okay? And what I'd like to know is where is the center of mass? So suppose it is that stool, and I want to know where is the center of mass such that I can take this pointed stick and put it on that one point and support it. Okay? That's the problem. But now I've set it up generally, so this is now some arbitrary shape. Okay? So if I give you a problem, I will specify that shape very specifically. This is right now sort of general. So how do we do this? What would you be given? What you're told is that the object has a mass density that is a function of R, where R is some vector that goes from the origin to an arbitrary point inside this thing. And so I just made it arbitrarily complex because I'm telling you I have some weird shape, and in addition, the mass density of this thing can vary. Okay? So it could be a big block of foam with little pieces of lead embedded in there or something. It could be some nasty thing. And so there's some function of the mass density with respect to R. In general, in physics, when we talk about a three-dimensional mass density, also, as it turns out, a three-dimensional charge density, as you'll see in Physics 114 and use a lot, we give it a symbol rho. Just for reference, I don't know that you'll see any problems like this, but it certainly will happen in 114. If we were talking about something which is just two dimensions, this same thing, it would be a two-dimensional density, you would be given the symbol sigma. And if it were just a line, like a very thin rod, and you were asked to find the center mass of that rod, and it may be set up so that its density can vary along the rod, then we would give it a symbol lambda. So that's just sort of convention. At any rate, in this case, I'll call it rho. So what that means is that if I go to some little point here, at this point, let me say that I have a little differential volume, dV. It will have a little differential mass, dm. And dm, for that little volume, will be equal to the mass density rho at that point times dv.
So if I have something and say it has a uniform mass density, if I want to know what its mass is, I can multiply the mass density times its volume. Right? So I'm doing exactly that here, except I'm only dealing with this one little piece. I have to use differentials here because right now in this problem, the mass density can be changing smoothly. So that means it's not a discrete thing, right? So I have to have a function, rho, changes smoothly in here. And what I would like to do is to consider it only over a tiny little spot where it's not going to change because the spot is so tiny. And when I do that, my intuition works. I know that mass is equal to rho times d, right? Which is what I'm doing, but I have to use these little differentials because I have to make it a little tiny thing.
So if we imagine that I have this mass and I divide it up into a million tiny little pieces, I can actually use my equation that we've already used. I can calculate the center of mass of this thing along the x direction, for example, xcm, as equal to the sum over I of x sub I times each of the little differential masses, d sub m I, and add to that the sum over I of each of the little masses, dm sub I. Okay? So this is exactly, if I were to break it into, you know, a trillion little pieces of dm, this is how we calculate it. But we'd be here all day trying to calculate it because a trillion's a lot. So if you... So what we do is we take it and we go to the continuous limit. Or another way to say that is that your little dv goes to zero, if you want to think about that. Then this becomes the integral of x times dm over the integral of dm over the entire volume of this object. So we basically go to the limit where the volumes become tiny or the dms become tiny, and in that case the sum of x dm becomes the integral of x over the mass. Okay? And we do that over this entire beast, okay, the whole mass. Now, generally speaking, you don't work in mass, you work in this function. You're given a density function that tells you how the density changes as a function of time. So to convert that to mass, you have to work in volume. So generally speaking, this thing becomes the integral of x times rho dv over the volume. Because dm is equal to rho dv at that point. So the density is changing as a function of where you are. So as you integrate over the entire volume, you have this function that tells you how the density changes as compared to where you are, and it gets multiplied by dv and then weighted by x. And down here, you're just summing up all the mass. So I take rho, whatever it is, wherever that little dv is, and I multiply rho times that dv, I get a dm, and I add up all the little dms, which is what the integral is. So this would be xcm in the continuous limit. Similarly, we'd have ycm is equal to the integral of y rho of r dv over the volume. The bottom here is just the total mass in both cases. So if I want to write this in terms, and the same for z, which means I can combine the three into a vector, so you might see the total vector center mass is equal to the integral over r vector dm do the mass-weighted average position here, you'll note that the mass for each piece weights each piece, but in the bottom you really just have total mass. So I'm really just extrapolating from that, which means the bottom doesn't have the position weighting. It's the piece that sort of gives you the average. Okay, so you guys are all happy with this.
Ready to do problems. All right. So we're going to actually do a couple of problems. We'll do one that's a little bit more discreet but subtle first, and then we'll do one that actually really uses these integrals so you can try to get a feeling for how that actually works.
If some of you are sitting there going, holy crap, I should have taken some more calculus. Anybody thinking that? Got at least one, yeah. My guess is it's more than one. There is a common... I mean, if you've seen integrals before in your calculus class, then you've actually had enough math to be doing 113 and 114. Trust me, it doesn't mean you have any freaking idea what an integral is. Because I don't think most mortals don't when they finish their calculus. No offense to the math department, but they really don't teach you what integrals intuitively are. Okay? So I'm going to do a problem now. We're not so much going to use the integrals, but I'm going to do another one, which basically we're going to take a baseball bat, and it's going to be a continuous distribution, and we're going to do this integral. I'm going to try to explain to you how to think your way through it. I'm doing that in part, I mean, it's a legitimate part of this class, but it's also true that it's the kind of thing you're going to do a whole lot more of in 114. So, just try to learn it here. Don't sit there and get angry that you didn't know it beforehand, because it's actually what the course here in course 114 are about. It's the place where you probably will finally understand what an integral is. Okay? Just sitting there. Alright. So let me do, to give you a sense of the usefulness of this kind of strange center mass stuff. If you have something of uniform density, then you can use a symmetry argument to know where the center of mass is going to be. If I have a baseball, well, okay, that's a bad example. But imagine I have a spherical ball of uniform density. Where's its center of mass going to be? Right in the center. Right? Because if it's of uniform density, then I know to balance it, I would put my finger right at the center along this axis. If I turned it, I would put it right at the center of that axis. And if I turned it again, whatever, it always... So the point, if I could put my finger at a point and support it, it would be right in the center of the thing. Okay? If I have a wheel, a uniform wheel, where would I support it? I'd put my finger right in the axis. Okay? So, if I have a uniform beam, how do I support it? I would put my finger right at the middle. So it is fair enough to actually say center of mass is at this point by symmetry. That's actually a literal physics argument you can use if it's legit. Okay? So, it's okay to use that intuition, and it really does pop out of all the mechanics that we just did, when you can convince yourself that if I have something that's of uniform density, that the center of mass is right at the middle. But your intuition actually works. At any rate, so what I'd like to do is to take something that I think, where the answer is not so obvious, and let's see if we can determine what the answer is. Let us suppose we have a round disk, which has a radius 2R, okay? And let us say it has some thickness t, and it has a uniform mass density rho. And I'm going to take a saw and remove, without removing material, so it's not quite a real saw, I guess,
I'm going to remove a circular plug which has a radius big R, which means it's going to be exactly 2R in diameter. And I'm going to remove it in such a way that this line along the X goes through the center point of both this plug that I removed and this original disk. Okay? And then the question is, once I remove this plug, where is the center of mass along X for the remaining part of the disk? That is, this strange-looking... It's not quite a moon, but this sort of strange-looking piece. Where would its center of mass along X be? Which I think is not at all obvious. Not to me. Okay? So what I want to do is to take advantage of things. What I know, I mean, if I look at this, I actually do know something. I know where the center of mass of this big disk is, and I know where the center of mass of this plug itself is, by symmetry. I know, because this has uniform density, I know the center of mass of this plug is right at that point on X, right at the center of the plug. And if I think of this entire disk, including this piece, I know that its center of mass is right there. Right? So now what I'd like to do is to imagine that this round piece, which includes this piece, has its center of mass at this point, and it is made up of two separate things. One is this piece, and one is that piece. And I want to calculate the center of mass position knowing that. So I can say that X, that is the center of mass coordinate for the total disk, the total big disk, is going to be equal to the mass of the plug times the center of mass X position for the plug plus the mass of the disk minus the plug, which would be this weird shape thing. I don't know how to describe it other than the disk minus the plug, times the X of the disk minus the plug over the mass of the plug plus the mass of the disk minus the plug. And what you have here is what you're asked for. You okay with that? And this is just the total mass. All right. So let's look at this. I will define X equals 0 here. So this, the X position for this round piece is going to be at X equal R, because it would be this point. The center of mass of the large plug is going to be 2R. Okay? So this equation says that X center of mass total disk, sorry, I'm substituting in now. The X center of mass total disk we already know
is going to be 2 big R. That's going to be equal to the mass of the plug, which I'm going to leave as mass of the plug for the moment, times X of the plug, which is going to be at 1R, plus the mass of the disk minus the plug, times X of disk minus the plug. Boy. D minus P, D minus P, over the total mass. So to calculate the total mass, this will be equal to the volume of the total disk times rho, which we say is some uniform density. Did I write that down? Yeah, the uniform density rho. So the volume of a total disk, which has a radius of 2R, if I'm not mistaken, right, is equal to the area of the circle of radius 2R, which is going to be pi times 2R squared, right? The area of a circle is equal to pi R squared. So in this case, the volume of this thing is going to be the area, which is going to be pi times 2R squared times the thickness T. So if I want to know the mass is going to be equal to that volume times rho. So M is equal to pi times 2 big R quantity squared times T times rho. Right? I wasn't given T or anything, so this is one of those things where you just have to sort of muddle through and see what happens. Here, this is equal to... This is now, the plug is a circle of radius 1R. So this is going to be equal to the mass of the plug is equal to pi times 1R squared times T times rho. And this piece is going to be equal to the difference between these two things, which is going to be the total mass minus the mass of the plug, which I've already calculated basically, because this I have. So in principle I have the radius, I have rho, and the thickness, so I can in principle calculate those, and this is just the difference. It turns out though, if you'll note, that this term, that term, and this term all have T, they all have rho, they all have this factor of, on the bottom, they all have this factor of R squared. And then you've got what these positions are. So, and the pi's, so a lot of that stuff just cancels. So if I expand it out, which I'm going to only do a bit of here, and you can prove I'm right. 2R is equal to R squared rho pi T R plus 3R squared, if you work it out, rho pi T times X of D minus the plug over 4R squared rho pi T. So a lot of this stuff cancels out, and you end up with 2 times big R is equal to big R plus 3x d minus the plug over 4. At any rate, this turns out to be 7/3 of R. Two and a third of R. That would be measured from this point. We're asking, where along this axis would be the center of mass of this weird shape? Naively, where would you put your finger to balance that? You have most of the mass over here,
So I would think I would put my finger to this side of the midpoint, somewhere over here, maybe there. The answer that we just calculated is 7/3. 7/3 is 2 1/3 r. So this would be 2r right here, plus 1/3 r. This would be another r. So it'd be about right here. Which sort of makes sense, I think, as to where it might balance.
See, this problem set's going to be so much fun. You're going to be excited. So, anyway.